On this week's According to Sources podcast, I'll give some new thoughts on Arconic, Barnes & Noble's, the Celgene Bristol-Myers spread, QEP Resources, and lastly, Mellanox. I'm Mike Samuels, founder and portfolio manager of Broome Street Capital, and this is According to Sources for the week of January 13th, 2019.
It's crossing the tape right now. Let me explain what's happening here.
Some breaking news to share with you this morning, M&A related.
There's good activism.
I think eBay is in that situation. They got a jewel in PayPal.
There's bad activism.
Unfortunately, JCPenney was a dying company.
Examples of activism gone awry.
It was not a surprise to me that that deal fell through.
Hello and welcome to According to Sources, a podcast devoted to the subject of deal speculation, merger arbitrage, activism, and the sources that both cover and surround them. First, a couple of house cleaning items. Just a disclaimer, as always, this is a reminder, this is not investment advice, but merely the opinions of myself, Broome Street Capital, and According to Sources. Number two, while I try to make this a weekly podcast, I sometimes tweet my ideas out in real time, if it's time sensitive, and the handle on that Twitter is at Accord to Sources. That's at ACCORDTO Sources. Next, one of the reasons I put myself out there each week is to be corrected or even proven wrong. So if you think I'm off base, if you think I'm missing information, if there's a situation that you find compelling that I'm not discussing, you can email me. And the email there is michael@accordingtosourcespodcast.com. And I do try to answer as many emails as I can. And on occasion, I'll just read them out on the air as well. And lastly, as many of you know, I've been doing a Merger Masters podcast series, which is based on Kate Welling's new book. And this week, I'll be interviewing both John Paulson and John Bader of Halcyon. I will be posting those next Sunday. If you have any questions, anything that you've been dying to ask any of those two individuals, again, you can tweet me or you can email me. Okay, so on to what's been going on so far in 2019. Happy New Year. I'm going to start with Barnes & Noble as it continues to be my biggest position. The important catalyst for this company, the event that media reports have written is the barometer for which buyers of this company will gauge value, was and has always been the 2018 holiday comp store sales. And BKS hasn't comped positively in 3 years. So the comps were up 1.3% over the 9-week holiday period, and they were up 4% from Black Friday to Christmas. However, when they released this, they also stated that full year EBITDA may drop 10% due to higher advertising costs and a higher promotional markdown environment. The stock, which was trading as high as $7.80 before the numbers, closed at $6.34 on Friday. Craig Hallam, which is one of the few analysts who covers this name, actually interpreted the news positively and defended the stock, quote, "While the lower EBITDA guidance is somewhat disappointing, we believe the improved comp performance represents a strong reversal after several years of negative comp results. While management has been able to reduce expenses to maintain bottom line results, the improved top line results offer a new potential for future bottom line growth. Combined with a low valuation of 4.4 times EV to EBITDA, even with cash at its seasonal low point and positive free cash flow, we believe the risk reward has tilted in favor of the stock following several disappointing holiday results." And again, they have a $10 target on it. They think the company could be bought for $10. So the question is, do the positive comps outweigh the miss in the EBITDA? Now, Craig Hallam thinks so. I actually, despite my position, I tend to disagree. If the comps were only generated from advertising and markdowns, then it seems to me, at least, that it was simply a tactic by the company to dress it up for a sale, to create the illusion of a company that's doing better than it actually is. There's no question the story, in my mind, got a little worse with these sales numbers, not better. So what now? Well, I'm not going to sell it here, but I'm also not buying any more stock here. Here's what we have on our side, at least right now. The headlines going forward from this point on are going to revolve fairly pretty much around the sales process, which again kicked off in October. So we're about 3 months in. And secondly, and most importantly, the stock is still extremely cheap, even at the bottom end of the revised EBITDA range, which in this case would be from 158 to 180 million. It's only selling at this point for 4.7 times. Now, Craig Hallam, again, thinks the stock could be bought for 10. It's difficult to value retailers like this, the ones with declining growth in a buyout scenario. And, you know, for reference point, Staples, the office retailer, was bought out in 2017 for about 5.4 times EBITDA. In a recent note on GameStop, another struggling retailer on the block, an analyst at Jefferies, Stephanie Wissick, said the following, quote, valuing the business in a takeover, and again, she's talking about GameStop here, retail takeovers in highly competitive categories tend to fetch 7 to 8 times EBITDA multiples. She extrapolates that GME in this case can fetch $17 a share in a discounted scenario to this. She enjoys the valuation there. She likes it. And for reference, 7 times the low end of the EBITDA range from Barnes & Noble would still equal over $11 a share. It'd be $11.33. The reason that I've always found Barnes & Noble more compelling than a name like GameStop or some of these other private equity retail situations has simply been the laundry list of activists and well-known investors over the years that have been linked to the brand. A reminder, John Malone was once involved, Ron Burkle was once involved, Tom Sandel, Jana Partners. Clearly, there's something here, there's value here. So while I'm not buying more stock, I'm also not selling. I think the company does get sold in the next few months, and that it's less of a question of if it gets sold and more of a question of just what price it gets sold at. Okay, moving on. The second stock I want to discuss is Mellanox. Shares fell over 10% on January 3rd after the company announced the hiring of a new permanent chief financial officer. The market interpreted the news to imply that no deal is imminent, and several analysts defended the notion that a deal can still occur despite the hire, but to be honest, the news did make me lose a bit of confidence. The man they hired, his name is Doug Ahrens. He left a job at a company called Global Logic to come and work here. And frankly, I'd assume, I mean, at least I would, if I was transferring jobs, some assurances that I'd be working someplace more than, you know, the 6 months that it would take to close a takeover. I sold half my position that day on the 3rd at 83. This past week, I sold the rest of the position and actually swapped instead into the February 95, 115 call spread. I paid $2.10 for that. My thought process being either this deal is happening or it's not happening, meaning the original reporting said it would happen at the end of December, and then later the Israeli paper that mentioned Microsoft as a potential buyer said that that entrance could have postponed the process. I can't imagine that it's going to postpone the process too long. So thought process being it's either happening in January or February, or perhaps it's not happening at all. And I just felt the risk reward of being in the calls was better. Also, the calls do capture the January 30th earnings event. So no more common equity in Mellanox, but I do own those call spreads. Stock three is Arconic, ARNC. I sold my January 21 strike calls literally hours before the event about the headline about the 22 deal hit Bloomberg that day, which was frustrating. But the 22 deal, you know, A, the 21 calls probably won't have much value anyway. Number two, the $22 number seems so low that it makes me think that it was basically the only number Apollo could possibly raise financing at. And essentially, I'm guessing, told Arconic this is a take it or leave it scenario. And I guess they're taking it. So personally, I've lost enough money in this name that I'm just done with it. Sometimes I have to say enough is enough. Again, the timing on that was supposedly is mid-January. So moving on from Arconic. Stock four is QEP. Elliott this week bid $8.75 on paper. It's sort of an indication of a bid. And frankly, I'm amazed that the stock traded overbid. I mean, I understand that the deal is far less complex than Athena Health was, but wouldn't one still expect the process of due diligence, running an auction? I think they're clearly still trying to flush out another buyer, as they always are. And the closing of the deal would imagine, I would imagine this would take 6 to 9 months at least, all of these things, maybe more. So, and the market, I think, is discounting the fact that there could be a wide range of variables that could occur over that time, most notably that oil could continue to sell off, that Elliott's bid isn't binding, or that QEP could simply choose to remain independent. It's not something I'm playing really in either direction currently. And lastly, the final situation I want to discuss today, and clearly the deal of the year, is Bristol-Myers and Celgene. Similar to Red Hat on its first day of trading post the IBM announcement, the spread here really blew out, over 18% gross, and if you believe the deal can close in 9 months, nearly 25% annualized. And that doesn't even include the $9 CVR, which is several years out, but it should be considered. I guess for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to value that at zero for now. So I did identify six main reasons why I believe the spread is currently this wide, and I just want to gloss over those right now. So number one, clearly there are those who believe that another big pharma company could come over the top for Bristol, making it a scary spread to put on. Highly unlikely for several reasons. First, just history. So recall when it reminded me of when Shire was first buying Baxalta a few years back. We had rumors that Allergan was going to buy Shire and disrupt that deal. That didn't happen. When Takeda was bidding for Shire, there was rumors Pfizer would come over the top for that company. That didn't happen. You just rarely see overbids of this size. Also, David Faber recently said there's nothing cooking in terms of anything regarding Bristol-Myers. Albert Bulla, the incoming CEO of Pfizer, all but stated that he really doesn't want to take any large integration risks. And Ian Reid, who's the former or outgoing CEO of Pfizer, who really tried to create value any way possible, break up, you know, spinoffs, any, you know, during his tenure, he clearly passed on Bristol-Myers. So I really just don't see it happening. Reason two is, you know, somewhat related to reason one, the idea that an activist will take some sort of stake in Bristol and try to disrupt the vote and or put Bristol into play. Now, recall in 2016 and 2017, JANA Partners got on the board of Bristol. Then there was the Wall Street Journal in February of 2017 reported that Carl Icahn had, in fact, taken a stake in the company. We never really heard anything from him regarding this. Now, in the wake of Icahn's attempted disruption of the Cigna Express Scripts deal, it wouldn't be shocking to see him try again here. But just remember, in terms of a vote, Cigna got 90% of the vote to buy Express. Takeda got 88% of the vote to buy Shire. People seem to like this combination. If Icahn did in fact go public with the Bristol stake, I could see ARBs using that opportunity to put the spread on rather than take it off. And lastly, Icahn was on Fox Business last week. He alluded to the fact that he had a large new position, which fueled more fears that perhaps it was Bristol. But David Faber revealed Friday that, in fact, Icahn has a new stake in Caesars. So maybe the rumors of Bristol can finally go away a bit. Reason three for the spread being so wide, the overarching fears that never seem to go away about just overall drug price reform, tweets from President Trump. Yeah, I think we'll continue to get those sort of knee-jerk movements, but one has to believe that Bristol and Celgene management isn't worried, and therefore perhaps I shouldn't be either. Number four, the idea of, you know, I have time to buy it. I don't need to be in a rush to put this on now. The deal's going to be closing in 9 months. I kind of agree. You know, December was an extremely volatile month. We did see spreads widen and significantly in some cases. So I understand the thought that, well, if the market perhaps sells back off again, these spreads could widen, and what is the rush? Number five, the idea of Revlimid patent litigation. Bristol stated very clearly on the conference call that they're comfortable with sort of the IP debate surrounding Revlimid and that they feel good about the valuation. And number six is just relative safety in the ARB world, meaning people just think it's safer to buy a name like Red Hat and get 9%. Rather than risk the variability of Celgene, which is about, you know, 12 or 13. And to be honest with you, I kind of agree. So that is Bristol Celgene. Again, the deal front seems fairly quiet at the moment, but I did just want to check in with some thoughts this week. And again, next week I'll be posting interviews with both John Paulson and John Bader. If you have any questions, if there's anything that you ever wanted to ask either of these two guys, just again, email me, tweet me. Again, the Twitter is at Accord to Sources, and the email is michael@accordingtosourcespodcast.com. Again, this has been According to Sources for the week of January 13th, 2019, and I will see you next week.